there was no question but that the trust itself was designed to confer a personal financial benefit, and that triggers the Alaska Ethics Act.
Sarah Palin will give back the money from her legal defense fund. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 24th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Supreme Court decision throws the government's corruption case against Bruce Weirach into question.
Well, I think it's unlikely that this case can proceed. The government has the ultimate authority to decide whether to keep going.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Former Governor Sarah Palin has agreed to return all of the donations to her legal defense fund that were paid into it while she was still governor. The settlement agreement was announced today in Anchorage. Palin will return more than $387,000 that was collected while she was governor. The complaint was filed in April of 2009, soon after the Alaska Fund Trust was set up by Palin, seeking donations to help her pay legal fees to fight the numerous other ethics complaints that had been filed against her. Anchorage attorney Tim Patuminas was the independent counsel who handled the matter for the Alaska Personnel Board. Patuminas says there were problems with the trust and the way it was presented. The website stated it was the official site for Governor Palin, and references on the site asked for help for Palin to defend herself so she could do her job. Patuminas says Palin explained the official designation on the site was to differentiate it from others that could spring up online.
And it was my conclusion that that may have been a good motivation, but the law is pretty strict about not allowing you to refer to or use the public office as a vehicle for raising private funds.
Patuminas says another troubling aspect was the trustee who managed the fund, Kristen Cole, was a public official who had been appointed by Palin to various boards and positions. This was problematic because Cole had authority to name other beneficiaries, which could have included other public officials. Patuminas says there is no evidence of attempts at influencing other public figures, but he says the law requires a reasoned decision under the Ethics Act.
We don't allow registered lobbyists who are attempting to influence government to give a gift in any amount. And most citizens are not allowed to give, without report, at least more than 150. In this instance, the trustee was not a lobbyist, but was herself a public official. And my reasoning was that if you can't let a lobbyist give even $50 because they're trying to influence government, you can't let a public official who actually makes policy as opposed to trying to influence serve in this capacity.
Patuminas determined that although the Ethics Act was violated, it was not a knowing violation on Palin's part because she had consulted three separate law firms about the legality of setting up the defense fund. They determined the structure was legal. Palin's primary attorney, Thomas Van Flein, didn't always agree with the conclusions of the other attorneys and wanted to consult the state attorney general before the site launched to be certain it would pass muster with the Ethics Act.
Mr. Van Flein wanted to go to the Attorney General and say, this is what we propose to do. Would you take a look for us? And the governor had done that on a couple of occasions in the past, and it came out well for her. And so I had some criticism for the failure to follow Mr. Van Flein's own advice. The governor did receive contrary advice and rather straightforward advice that it wasn't necessary.
Even though it wasn't a knowing violation, Patuminas says it was a violation that still required action.
The governor fully cooperated with our investigation, was fully cooperative and supportive of our attempts to get it corrected, and that's why it was resolved the way it was.
He says he hopes the resolution of the matter will set a precedent for future political leaders in Alaska. The State Personnel Board requested that the decision be made public. Patuminas says Kristen Cole could remain the trustee for the fund if she relinquishes her public official role. The governance government's case against former state legislator Bruce Weirach took a major hit today with a Supreme Court decision. It vacated a lower court ruling that said Weirach can be tried for honest services fraud and has sent the case back to the Court of Appeals. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The Honest Services Law says elected officials and the heads of big companies should serve the public honestly, but the Supreme Court ruled today that it has been used in a way that's too broad and far-reaching. It says the law should only apply to people in positions of public trust who take or offer bribes and kickbacks. The federal government has used the law to prosecute a wide range of white-collar crimes. Bruce Weirach was accused of breaking the Honest Services Law for not disclosing that he'd asked oilfield services company Vico for a job. At the same time, he was representing Juno in the state house and voting on legislation affecting Vico. That doesn't violate state law, but the federal government wants to try Weirach for mail fraud since he used the U.S. mail to solicit Vico for employment. The feds say he should have disclosed that he'd asked for the job. But the Supreme Court's ruling today that the law only covers bribery and kickbacks now puts the government's case in question. Weirach's attorney, Doug Pope, says he talked to his client first thing this morning.
I would just say that we're all pleased that the court ruled the way it did. It wasn't a surprise. But other than that, we really just trying to process it all ourselves.
Pope says today's ruling does strike a big blow to the government's case.
It certainly eliminates their theory that you can charge someone with a federal crime merely because they failed to disclose information that the government thinks they should have disclosed. It certainly cuts out that theory, but whether it cuts out the count itself, I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see.
Pope says he suspects the Court of Appeals will throw the case back to the court in Alaska, but he says there's no way to know yet how it will proceed. Court watcher and attorney Cliff Groh in Anchorage writes the blog Alaska Political Corruption and has been following the case. Groh agrees that it's too early to say that Weirach is totally off the hook, but he says the government has a much steeper climb.
The short answer is, although I think it's unlikely that this case can proceed, the government has the ultimate, the Department of Justice has the ultimate authority to decide whether to keep going. Remember, they have other counts in this case, and they could try to prove their case on other theories, like traditional bribery theories. The big problem they've always had in this case is that Bruce Weirach didn't get money.
Groh says instead, the government alleged the promise of future benefit, but today's Supreme Court ruling says that's not a crime. Melanie Sloan, the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, says Weirach hugely benefits from today's decision. But she says, in her opinion, that's not good.
The public should have confidence that public officials are acting in the public interest and not in their own private interest. Mr. Weirach, by soliciting a job from somebody who he was making decisions that impacted, there was definitely a conflict of interest there. And we expect and have a right to expect our officials not to act in their own private interests when they're on the public payroll.
The High Court ruled today on three cases related to the Honest Services Law. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had the opinion in all of them. The first and main one involved former Enron chief executive Jeffrey Skilling, who was charged with violating the public trust when he schemed to hide Enron's poor finances. The court today found Skilling did not conspire to commit honest services fraud because he didn't take bribes. The other case involved media mogul Conrad Black, who's accused of bilking people out of millions of dollars through bogus legal fees and agreements. Both Skilling and Black's cases will go back to the lower courts. The Supreme Court could have completely tossed out the Honest Services Law, and while the court agreed it's too vague, it did keep it intact. Melanie Sloan with CREW says still this dramatically changes the job of prosecuting public officials. She says the law was the single most used tool in corruption cases.
This has been a huge setback to prosecutors who are now going to be forced to charge bribery instead, and bribery has a much higher standard of proof. You can't simply show that an official benefited in some way. You need that direct quid pro quo, and that will be much harder for prosecutors. And I think that it is imperative that Congress move very quickly to change the law so that honest services fraud is once again prohibited.
While Crewe lobbies Congress to tighten up the law, the Justice Department has to figure out what to do in the trio of cases dealt with by the Supreme Court today. Tracy Schmaller with the Justice Department in Washington says they'll continue to hold corrupt officials accountable. She says they're studying whether the court's interpretation leaves them with the tools they need to ferret out corruption. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, pilots in Alaska embrace GPS technology ahead of the rest of the country.
It's like a Wii mixed with an Xbox. You have everything you need.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
GPS may be standard these days in cars and cell phones, but the aviation industry still relies largely on outdated radar technology. Alaska is one of the first sites in the nation to change that. The Federal Aviation Administration announced today air traffic control is officially launching the satellite-based system in the state after a long testing period. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Radar has worked well for air traffic control for over 50 years, but there are big gaps in the system. The radar signal can't pass through mountains, for example, so air traffic controllers have had to come up with other ways to track planes flying into places like Juneau. Hank Krakowski is chief operating officer with air traffic for the FAA. He says radar has a lot of limitations.
The way we've been running the system is equivalent to the old telephones that you had in the house 20 years ago, where they were plugged into a wall and you couldn't really move them around.
The FAA started testing the GPS system in Alaska more than a decade ago, and Krakowski says the fatal accident rate has dropped by nearly 50%.
So the safety improvements are clear, and they're demonstrated, and they were pioneered here in Alaska.
Once the technology is widespread, air traffic controllers will be able to fly airplanes closer together, and weather conditions like low clouds and fog, which can slow takeoffs and landings, won't be a problem. But right now, fewer than 10% of planes in Alaska are equipped with GPS technology. Lee Ryan with Ryanair and Unalakleet was an early adopter. He has enthusiastically embraced the benefits of the new system.
It's like a Wii mixed with an Xbox. You have everything you need.
Flying in the Alaskan bush used to be one of the country's riskiest professions. But Ryan says with GPS, those days are coming to an end.
It turns us into those big carriers like United, like Delta. You know, it makes us that safe. So now there's really no more bush pilots. We're all big, safe, professional operators serving the people and those who choose to live in Western Alaska and throughout Alaska.
The system also gives pilots access to weather data right in the cockpit. Ryan says that's allowed him to make better decisions about when to fly. In the air, he says it's helpful to be able to see other planes flying nearby.
Clear weather days are when accidents happen, when people get complacent and not really paying attention. And that move-in map makes you pay attention. It shows you that traffic's coming. The traffic will light up if it gets too close.
Ryan says outfitting the planes is expensive. It costs over $80,000 to install the technology in one of Ryanair's bigger planes. Some airline operators say they can't afford the equipment and have asked the government to help pay for it. But Lee Ryan says he has been able to recover the installation costs in just 1 year.
By taking out some of the old legacy equipment, archaic stuff, you know, like I invented fire, but we took those out. They're heavy equipment and put in this new GPS technology. It's 25 pounds lighter. So if we run a flight, four flights a day, you know, there's 100 pounds. If we run that for 300 days a year, that's a lot of weight we're taking out of our airplanes and able to put on as revenue.
But if the benefits to pilots like Lee Ryan are clear, air traffic controllers aren't embracing GPS quite as eagerly.
As a controller, and the controllers in this building, we're not really sure what to make of this stuff.
Tim Crowley has worked at the Anchorage Air Traffic Control Center for 25 years. He says it hasn't been an easy road figuring out how to mesh the old radar system with the new GPS technology.
Controllers and the air traffic control community has been playing catch up with this for a long time. And we're starting to see some pretty good benefit from that. But the controllers downstairs appreciate the technology. The equipage has been a little bit of an issue for us. The aircraft that have it, we can do a lot of things with. It's the aircraft that don't have it that we struggle with.
Crowley calls it a work in progress. He says the technology was rolled out in airplanes first and then outfitted to work with air traffic control centers, a process that wasn't always smooth. But he says there's no doubt GPS will be the standard across the U.S. in the next 10 to 15 years. The FAA expects to begin rolling out GPS across the country by 2013. All planes that fly into the nation's busiest airports will have to have the technology on board by 2020. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska is home to some unusual bacteria, and when conditions are right, the little bugs can sometimes cause flare-ups of unusual maladies. The Federal Center for Disease Control Research Facility in Anchorage keeps tabs on known and sometimes little-known invaders. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, recent studies in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have helped the agency to detect just why certain illnesses are more prevalent in some areas than in others.
The unremarkable two-story, dun-colored building would never attract attention unless one noticed the Arctic Disease Research Lab in discreet lettering on a sign inside the driveway. Inside the building, upstairs, there's a rabbit warren of cubicles, each holding a computer and a researcher. That's where Dr. Jay Wenger works. Wenger, a public health specialist, is studying respiratory ailments.
It so happens that there are a number of respiratory diseases and what we would say invasive bacterial diseases that do happen to occur up here, often at higher rates than other places. And those are also diseases for which vaccines have been developed and are given routinely.
Wenger says the CDC gets involved when it seems that diseases are recurring despite available vaccines.
And so the study that we did was to look and try to evaluate areas where disease seemed to be returning to try to find out what was going on.
He says determining factors in who gets a disease include lifestyle elements, such as crowded living conditions.
High number of persons in a household makes it easier for you to transmit any colds or pneumonias or any respiratory disease. And we found that, indeed, the crowding data from YK Delta showed that in that region, probably we have the highest number of households with a large number of people in them.
Dr. Wenger has written a paper published in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal examining the role of water supply in an illness called invasive pneumococcal disease.
So there are actually 90 different types of pneumococcal bacteria, and some of them tend to cause more disease, more serious disease than others. Now, when we talk about invasive pneumococcal disease, we're talking about a situation where the pneumococci that live in the throat can sometimes get into the bloodstream. They can get into the lungs. And then when they cause pneumonia and result in bacteria that gets into the blood, that can be a very serious disease.
90 types of bacteria pose a problem in defining which ones are the most virulent. Wenger says some are worse than others.
Probably the most serious infection that pneumococci can cause is meningitis. And meningitis is an infection of the lining around the brain. And bacterial meningitis in general is an extremely serious problem and a medical emergency. And if that's not treated with antibiotics very rapidly, the fatality rate is very high.
A vaccine developed in 2000 killed off 7 of the bacteria. At first use of the vaccine, the incidence of invasive pneumococcal disease went down, but after a while, the illness began escalating again. So the CDC studied areas where the disease returned to find out what was going on.
What we found basically was that the vaccine was working everywhere, and the invasive pneumococcal disease caused by strains in the vaccine went down. So that was perfect. But in some areas, and in particularly in the YK Delta, disease was caused by some other serotypes, some other types of the pneumococci that were not in the vaccine. And it's those serotypes that cause most of this new disease.
Wenger says it's not unheard of that different strains of bacteria come up and replace the ones the vaccines fight. The CDC has to determine what causes that to find out what to do next. Wenger says they found that there was a link to available water supply, so the researchers took into account the proportion of houses in the YK Delta which had no running water.
We found that the highest rates of pneumococcal disease were in those with the fewest houses with in-home piped water, and that the lowest rates of pneumococcal disease were those that were best supplied with in-home piped water.
Wenger is quick to point out that lack of running water does not indicate sloppiness. It simply means that frequent hand washing is not available in homes without plumbing, nor is the use of hand sanitizers a viable substitute, as sanitizers have to be shipped in and can be costly, and they are not part of traditional living.
I think the new thing here was the association with water, which has not been so readily recognized for invasive pneumococcal disease. And it's another thing that will contribute to our ability to control it later.
The CDC has since started using a new type of vaccine, which kills off the most harmful bacteria.
We believe that use of that vaccine will get rid of this replacement disease that we've seen. We are hopeful that this will take care of most of the pneumococcal disease.
Prevention is worth a pound of cure, according to the old adage. Wenger says it's important to get children immunized. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
The Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority is backing away from the Beluga to Fairbanks gas line pipeline project it's been pursuing for the last year and a half. The ANGDA board meeting yesterday in Fairbanks voted to stop work. ANGDA CEO Harold Hines told the board the state corporation can't afford to continue the so-called B24 project.
It's become clear that to finish the process at this point will require more time and more resources than we foresee. There was no additional funds appropriated to us during the legislative process. And frankly, if we looked at the funds we had committed to moving the EIS process forward, we're tapped out.
The decision to drop the B2F project reflects the state legislature's creating and funding a new group charged with developing a plan for an in-state North Slope to Fairbanks and South Central gas line by next summer. The ANGDA board also voted yesterday to participate in the open seasons for two proposed large export gas lines. The authority will submit bids for capacity to carry gas for in-state use. Hines says ANGDA started working with Alaska Electric Utilities several years ago with the idea of aggregating demand and submitting bids.
The fundamental reason for doing it was that we have always visualized that by participating in this initial open season, the in-state gas users could generate probably a discount in the range of 30% to 40%.
Hines says participation during the open season allows bidders access to negotiated discount tariff rates that won't be available later. The non-binding open season bids will not commit any money to purchasing gas, but act as a placeholder for participation in either the TransCanada, ExxonMobil, or BP ConocoPhillips projects. A new program will help property owners on the Kenai Peninsula install electric fences to keep bears from getting into chicken coops and other attractants. The program is funded through the federal agency Natural Resources Conservation Service, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
You probably already know that bears pose a danger when they come in proximity to people or the food that people eat, and that people have used electric fences for many years to prevent such interaction. But what's WIP? The Wildlife Habitat Incentive Program is an NRCS program that, among other habitat efforts, might make these fences more common. The program is exclusive to the Kenai Peninsula.
One reason why it's sort of exclusive there is because the Kenai Peninsula brown bear holds a special status as a state-sensitive species.
NRCS state biologist Bill Wood also says the ultimate goal is to protect people, but also the bears themselves. That means getting bears to change their behaviors, but also getting humans to change their behaviors too. Wood says an electric fence can be part of a larger effort from residents to lower their footprint, or as he calls it, smell print.
People need to be conscious of their sights and what smell print that we have that makes it attractive to bears, and do what we can to try to reduce the size of that smell print.
Wood calls the voltage level safe. The purpose is not to physically harm the animal, but instead to offer something that's stronger than a bee sting that might make the bear forget about a particular sight. The idea is that the alternative to the irritation might be that a bear becomes a problem in an area, which sometimes leads to bears being killed to ensure public safety.
I think everybody understands that, you know, bears are really eating machines. And if a bear finds an easy meal without any bad consequences associated, there's a high likelihood it's going to be back.
What is an easy meal? The Central Kenai Peninsula has some commercial-level chicken coops, which can be eligible for the cost-sharing funding, but more common in this area are residential backyard livestock that might be even more at risk for bear interaction. District conservationist at the Kenai office, Meg Mueller, is not sure how many people have such coops, but chickens are not the only livestock.
Or hogs, one or two hogs, or several hogs, that kind of thing. Anything that's vulnerable to a bear attack would be eligible.
Mueller says people that apply get a visit from the department to assess what the fencing needs would be, but they evaluate other possible attractants.
See what they have for an operation, how a fence would fit into that, and also look at what there is for other attractants. You know, is it a nice tidy yard, or is there something else out there that's going to attract bears? Maybe a fish smoker, or garbage isn't handled appropriately.
And for the NRCS funding, an applicant would need to address all those issues. Wood says the department expects to fund about 70% of the cost of installing the electric fences. They vary in size depending on what they're protecting. A chicken coop, beehive, or small food supply might need a small fence, but he expects sizes to range all the way up to an acre. Total costs for fences would vary too, in the neighborhood of $2,500 to $5,000. Another area in Alaska where fences have been used in similar ways is the Katmai National Park along the Brooks River. Wood says Canadian forestry officials have also had similar success. Applications for the program go to the local NRCS offices like the ones in Kenai or Homer, or to the state office in Palmer. The program's funding begins in October. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Bad reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.